Welcome to the Space Beyond Scarce podcast. I'm your host, life and business coach, Kate Hawley. I work with entrepreneurs and creative changemakers who value depth, impact, and purpose. Many of my clients are like me. They dream of creating prosperity through the value they provide, but they also want equity for others and sustainability for our planet. The scarcity mindset of our culture tells us that this dream isn't possible, that we are not enough, that we don't have enough, that there is not enough for everyone, and that's just the nature of reality. But really, it's just the nature of predatory capitalism. I'm glad you're here because we are going to prove that sad story false and make better meaning to build our future with. Here we go. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Sweet Spot Summer Retreat. That's my retreat coming up July 27th through 30th in Vernonia, Oregon. If you are a woman-identified creative entrepreneur, visionary changemaker, or radical householder, I invite you to join me for 3 nights of just the right amount of luxury. We will enjoy farm-to-table meals, forest bathing, sauna lounging, creek wading, ukulele campfire sing-alongs, and I will be facilitating some workshops and play shops that help us turn off the to-do list brain and tap into a creative flow state for embodied problem solving that will leave you feeling replenished, inspired, and connected. Together, we'll do a variety of activities that are fun but also restorative, including some gentle yoga, some goat journaling — that's journaling next to goats — some creative play, some coaching, and some conversation. If you want more solitude, you can reserve a private cabin. If you want to make some new best friends, you can book a spot in a shared cabin. Or if you want to sleep under the stars, you can set up your own camp. You can find all the details at my website, katehawley.com, under the events tab, or just go to the link in the show notes. Registration closes June 26, 2023. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Space Beyond Scarce podcast. I'm here today with Kat Kosurek. Kat is a certified rolfer, yoga educator, and movement instructor in Portland, Oregon, and also is a former client of mine who has, I think, an amazing story to share, and I'm excited to ask her some follow-up questions about it, just from what I got to witness of Kat's journey over the last few years. So welcome to the show, Kat. So great to have you here.
Thank you, Kate. I'm excited to be here.
We're going to free range with our conversation today, as always.
Okay.
And if people are wondering what is today's conversation going to be about, I suspect we're probably going to touch on some things related to embodiment and your work as a rolfer and movement educator, and also a bit about your transition into that work from having a more corporate marketing career and really a different track before. But before we get into the whole story and the details, I always like to start by asking, what does scarcity mindset mean to you?
I was prepared for this question because you ask it on all of your podcast episodes. I think that the best way that I can answer that question right now has to do with how scarcity mindset shows up for me, how I know that I'm dealing with life and all that life throws at me in a way that's impacted by scarcity mindset. I've identified a few ways to notice that. One is scarcity mindset for me shows up in the way that I leave my body behind. There's sort of a dissociative thing that can happen where I'm not able to sense and feel what's happening from the inside, sort of that interoceptive information coming from, like, bubbling up from within. When that gets quiet, or when I feel like there's a block there, a lot of times it might suggest that I'm operating from a scarcity mindset. I also know that anytime I've slipped into binary thinking, like black and white, yes and no, that I am likely falling victim to a scarcity mindset. And my journey with scarcity mindset, I mean, it's been I can say now a long one. I think that I really started to examine this when you and I began working together in 2020, and I've gotten more rigorous with my thinking about it. And rather than like having a much larger educational lens on what is scarcity mindset, I think those two things are my invitations to reflect on. Am I thinking about what I'm dealing with from a place of resource and a place of groundedness? And thinking in my world also means feeling. So am I thinking and feeling about this thing that I'm looking at or that I'm pondering from a place of understanding resource and understanding my connection to self and to earth? Or have I been pulled away from myself? Have I been swept up in a different way of thinking and feeling that doesn't necessarily honor those aspects of who I am? And I think that there's many much larger systems at play that contribute to the ease with which I can get pulled out of those states of groundedness and ease. And I think that that's sort of a scarcity system that our society has us wrapped up into. That's a meandering answer for your question. How was
it? I love the answer. I think there's a lot in there. And the last thing you said is really important, I think. And for those who have listened to my podcast going way back, I do address it, but I think it's important to remember to readdress it, that scarcity mindset is not our fault or our problem or something we came up with. It's something that we are constantly being told is the reality and is the problem and is the thing we should be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And so that is a lot to work against. It's a lot to try to manage, right? To say, how would I stay in my body? As you're saying, how would I stay grounded? How would I stay resourced? How would I stay out of binary thinking inside of a system that is designed to very much shove me out of my body, shove me into binary thinking, shove me into that kind of like, well, how are you going to get enough of that to do that? So I really appreciate the answer. And I think it's very specific. And even in the answer you gave, it's already full of solutions in a way. It's already full of like, oh, so here's a way out and here's the way out. And they're not complicated, right? It's not like the way out is to make $1 million. The way out is to like, be like, what's up with my body right now? Or, you know, like, yeah. So I'm excited to talk to you more about how you get your way out of there to a more resourced place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I think what could be cool is if you would share a bit about the work you do now as a Rolfer and how that journey to doing that work started for you.
Oh, such a long answer. Okay. Let me see if I can be succinct. So the work that I do now, I'm a Rolfer, a yoga instructor, movement instructor, practicing in Portland. All of these things weave together in a way that's pretty difficult to actually separate. Rolfing, for those who don't know what it is or think it just sounds like a weird word, because it totally is just a weird word. It's a bodywork practice. It's a modality in structural integration, which is a category of manual therapy bodywork that takes into account the body's ability to show up in gravity and support itself and the movements that are required of it. So thinking about how we can use touch and tissue manipulation, you know, if you think of a massage, right? Massage is the much more universally understood term, even though it's so broad that barely anybody can actually describe it in a way that's agreed upon. Mm-hmm. You think about massage and touch, skin to skin contact, therapist to client body touch, applying that resource, but through a lens of how can I structurally support this person's body in a way that's going to help them live more comfortably and show up more fully. So I've had a couple of clients tell me that their experience of Rolfing was like massage therapy and physical therapy combined. We do a lot of movement. We do a lot of interoceptive work. Feeling inside of your body is a really big part of my practice, which is certainly a part of all Rolfing. But I think because of my background as a yoga instructor and my own journey with disembodiment and embodiment, that interoceptive language, interoceptive practice is a really big part of what I do as well. So
can you, sorry to interrupt, but just okay. In case there are people who don't know what interoception is, could you elaborate a little bit on like, what does that mean for,
yes, for you, for such someone a good who might question. Not know about it? Thank you. Okay. I'm going to start by separating two things. One is proprioception and one is interoception. This is my top-down thinking brain wanting to categorize. Our nervous systems have the capacity to sense things beyond our five senses that we're taught, right? Sight, sound, smell, touch, and hearing. And one of those things is called proprioception, which I start with because I think it's maybe the easier one to understand. If you were to close your eyes and touch your finger to your nose, that is your body's ability to know where it is in space without you having to consciously think about it. Your ability to move, to not bump into tables and door frames wherever you're going. If you're a yoga practitioner, your ability to like sense where your feet are relative to each other, this is all proprioception, how your container moves through space and relates to other things and objects in space. Interoception is a totally different thing, but it's also subconscious, or it exists outside of what we've learned as the five senses, in that our body also has the ability to sense things that are happening inside of it. And that could be something as, I'll say concrete, because I think that this feels a little bit more tactile to some people. That could be something as concrete as feeling your belly rumble, as feeling like your bowels churning, or it could be something as ethereal as feeling like energy moving in some part of your body. I think that interoception is something that's challenging for folks who are maybe introduced to it for the first time, because depending on where the person that you're learning it from has their own practice of interoception, you might be able to really connect with that, or you might not. I have a great example of this. I consider myself to work with interoception in my body quite a bit, but the things that I can feel in my body tend to fall a little bit more what I just described as tactile. Like, I'm feeling a thing and it feels very specific and certain to me. And I, a couple of years ago, was working with a therapist who was asking me to sense into how emotions were feeling in my body. And I had a really hard time with that. I had a really hard time with connecting what my brain and nervous system had mapped for me as my own interoceptive experience to emotions. And it got to the point where I was like, do you want me to make something up? Because I will. But that's kind of where I am in terms of that question, is I can tell you how it feels for my diaphragm to be moving and pushing the contents of my belly around. I can tell you how it feels to have my head stacked over my ribs. I can tell you how the weight in my feet feels, but I can't tell you where my sadness is right now. Like that for me is actually a very unapproachable thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not because that's a bad or incorrect or more advanced interoceptive skill. It's just another way that folks' nervous systems are oriented to the interoceptive practice. And so I offer that because I know that I've struggled with it in the past. And I know I've seen clients who have also struggled with maybe just not feeling like they have access to another person or another teacher's invitation for interoceptive awareness. And I think that just accepting that is great. Being like, oh, actually, this doesn't work for me, but there are other lenses through which we can develop that same skill set. Maybe skill set is the wrong term, but the reason that I'm using it is that there is a capacity to grow your ability to feel yourself and your body from the inside.
Yeah.
And so
it's so exciting, because I think, in fact, I just started writing a podcast I'm going to do on, you know, the nervous system as it relates to scarcity mindset. And one of the things that is a real go-to for me is when we feel like we don't have any resources, it's like, do you even know how much is happening right now on the inside of your body on your behalf without you doing anything? You don't have to lift a flipping finger, and you've got like all your whole autonomic nervous system is keeping you alive, literally, and supplying you with everything you need to be alive. Yeah. And I think sometimes we forget to notice that and appreciate that. And that's not to say we don't also need other things, but it is almost like it's its own portal, the portal to the what's happening on the inside for you. And when you can look at it, you open up this whole universe of resource and possibility that I think when you don't know it's there, or you kind of generalize about it and you don't appreciate it, you don't have as much choice, I think, with tapping into and utilizing those resources on your own behalf. Mm-hmm. I often tell the story of, I know you and I have both studied with the same yoga teacher, Todd Jackson, who one of these days I'll have to get Todd on the podcast because I think his way of teaching yoga is so, I don't even know if I could articulate how much it takes you to the space beyond scarce, in my opinion. It's just like, oh, there's so many things happening here. But the very first class I ever did with him, which was probably 15 years ago, by then I was pretty practiced and I was a yoga teacher myself, but I'd never heard a teacher use cues that took me into my body in the way that he did. And so I think we were working in bridge pose and he was having us do something with our liver. And I was like, this guy is nuts. Like, what is he talking about? Do this thing with my liver. But even as my brain was like, that doesn't make any sense. You can't control your liver. My body was totally responding to his cues and doing what he was saying. And I was like, what is happening? My body is responding, even though my brain is like, this doesn't make sense at all to me. And then the other amazing thing that happened is that this was a packed class of 30 something people. He was across the room from me and he looked over and just said, Kate. And then he gave me some verbal adjustment for whatever was happening with my liver. And once again, my body responded to what he said. And I was like, what is even happening? And how did he know what was happening in my liver from across the room? Like, how did he sense that? And that's, again, a story for, or a subject for another day, is how does he sense that from across the room, which is a whole magical wizardry that he pulls off in yoga. But I guess my point is, it opened a door for me of understanding that there's so much more choice. You can do things with your own liver and you don't even know that. Do you know what I mean? And that's like a level of mastery of turning inwards towards what else is possible, that I think a lot of people are looking outward all the time and saying, what else is possible that I can get or acquire or get other people to validate for me, when there's this other world in there.
Yeah, I can absolutely relate to that, and to the brain of being like, Todd, what are you, kidneys? Okay.
Yeah.
But to expand or maybe like expound upon that concept, I find that a lot of folks who come into my Rolfing clinic with pain, I have the privilege of working with folks who are experiencing a vast spectrum of types of pain. And I think that something that pain does that exacerbates scarcity mindset, or that exacerbates systems that incentivize scarcity mindset, is that it makes us feel like we have no agency, right? Like, being in pain and not understanding why can rob us of our sense of agency and our sense of resilience. And one of the things that seems to create more lasting impact than any touch that I do on the table is helping people to feel the full spectrum of their experience with their pain. Because, and this is completely not based in any research paper that I've read anywhere, it's just from my practice, what I hear at the beginning when I see clients who come in with pain, it's, oh my gosh, I'm in so much pain. Please help me. I've tried everything. And as we start to kind of peel back the layers of that, I learn that their ability or their interest in being curious interoceptively has been turned off, because to them, it feels like danger. It feels dangerous to inquire about and feel into their pain. And then the more that we kind of just gently broach that subject, the more that they understand that their experience with their pain changes, that it has maybe specific flare-up triggers, or maybe even that they already know what they can do to keep their pain at a lower intensity, but they weren't thinking about it consciously. Maybe it was just a subconscious thing that was happening. And so I have been just blown away by some of the results that I've seen and that clients have seen related to slowing down, feeling into their bodies, being curious, accepting that pain exists and that it will exist and that it will continue to exist. But the act of building that skill of feeling, and feeling not just the spot of the pain, but what else is going on with the body, provides an amazing amount of resource. And yes, like, they've received touch therapy. And I do believe that structural integration as a touch therapy is well positioned to help people with pain. And I'm noticing this thing in my clinic, which is, it's not just that. If they're going to go home and be able to resource themselves without having to pay lots of money to have somebody else push on their body, being able to build some of that internal awareness and internal resource is really, really powerful.
You know, hearing you talk about your work, I know we didn't quite get to your the journey leading up to it. And maybe this question is actually going there. I'm starting to feel curious because when I met you, when we first started working together, you were in what I think a lot of people would describe as a very successful career, right? As a corporate marketing professional. But you had this calling at the time to make a change. And I, at the time, I don't even know that you totally decided what kind of change. You knew it had to do with embodiment and with all of these beautiful things you're sharing with us now. So I guess the question that's emerging for me, well, the first question that's emerging is, how's it going? Because I know you just started your Rolfing practice like kind of last year. And I know that it sounds like you love it. So I guess the first thing I want to ask is like, do you love it? How is it to now be in the life and the dream that 3 years ago was such a scary, faraway reality to you?
I kind of wish people could see me right now. I'm like grinning. I am loving it so much. It is, I mean, there's no way that I could have pictured where I am now when we started working together 3 years ago. And every day, I'm just so excited. I talk about this a lot with my husband. With is in air quotes. I just do a lot of talking to my husband about this because he's been, you know, he's been the firsthand witness along the way. But I understand in a way that wasn't clear to me when I was in corporate, the use of the word practice, like my Rolfing practice. Every day is a practice, not just in terms of how I show up with clients and the work that I do with clients, but how I choose to allocate my time in a day, how I make decisions about teaching versus clinic time, how I make decisions about how I speak about what I do. All of this is just this, it's a journey. And I am loving that aspect of it in a way that I don't think I realized I would. And in a way that I don't think I realized I was lacking in my former corporate career. I was really nervous about leaving my corporate career for a lot of reasons. One of them was security. And I think this plays very heavily into your whole concept of scarcity. And I think it's why I really resonated with some of what you were saying when I initially reached out to you. But I was terrified. I was terrified of losing a regular paycheck. I was terrified of not knowing what my day, next week, next month was going to look like and what I could expect. And that was hard. That was a hard terror to digest and to integrate. And now that I'm on the other side of it, there's just so much joy in the thing that I was afraid of. There's so much joy in the knowing that the next day is not going to look like today and that I have so many opportunities and so many decision points ahead of me. And yeah, I'm really, really enjoying it. My practice, my private practice has been growing really steadily, which feels nice. I think I was bracing for more delay in terms of being able to add value. I don't know. I think that I just wasn't confident coming out of school, even though I know I did a great job at school and I know that I'm good at what I do. Just, you know, a little bit of the confidence was lacking, but I came out and opened a practice and it's been resonating. So all of it feels really good. Thank you for your help.
You are so welcome. And it's amazing to see what you've done and how much courage you've brought to this process and so many shifts in such a short amount of time. It's just really cool to see you on this end of it experiencing this. And I think it's so helpful for people to hear that because we all have some version of that. We're like, okay, that thing I want is on the other side of something so scary. I don't even know how I would face that. And so I think what I'm curious about is if you could describe, there's so much that we could talk about inside of this, like what happened in this journey. I think one of the things I want to ask you about is how you knew that what you were doing wasn't right for you and what it felt like to be called to this other thing.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that my answer is probably different than a lot of folks who make a transition out of corporate like I did. I had a great job. I was really pleased on paper with my job, and not even on paper. I liked my boss. My boss and I are like still friends. I had a good salary. I felt respected. I had a budget that was not too small to hit the goals that were set in front of me. My teammates were great. Like everything, if I could have made a checklist of all the things that I know I need from a job to be happy, every check mark was hit and I was still unhappy. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's ultimately where I landed around the time that I chose to reach out to you. I've always been somebody who in the corporate setting has struggled with burnout. And I've probably been through 3 like very big burnout cycles as a corporate employee that were either resulting in me leaving that job and finding other employment elsewhere, or like my manager having to really step in and set up boundaries for me because I was not setting them up for myself. And at the end of 2019, I was, you know, we had just hired, I was the leader of the marketing organization within this company. And I had just been involved with, and I basically had the final say on who was going to lead the sales organization because the prior person drove me nuts and thrust a lot of work on me. And I think my boss knew that I was going to leave if that happened again. So he involved me. He like made me his deciding person to help make that choice. And we hired this wonderful human who was incredibly supportive and I loved working with. And I remember sitting in a chair at home because I was working from home. And I was just like, why am I not excited about this? Why can't I get excited? Why am I feeling exhausted in a way that reminds me of burnout, even though now I also know that I'm not burnt out. I know that I have support. I know that I have resource. Mm-hmm. So that was a big turning point for me. And then I wound up going on a yoga retreat to Costa Rica with my teachers. And everybody who was there was not in corporate. They were in some other field, or they were self-employed, or they were in healing modalities. And I got to be immersed in a group of people who, to a large extent, like couldn't necessarily bitch with me about corporate stuff, which yeah. had been something that was a part of my self-soothing practice for so many years. Mm-hmm. And I think I looked at a lot of these people and was sharing with them, and they were like, well, why don't you just do something different? Right. Okay. Y'all aren't here for my whining. Y'all are here for, you know, helping me figure out what's going on and what I want to do. So coming out of that, that was January of 2020. I think that I had like 4 work trips where I did public speaking and trade shows, and then COVID hit and everything ended in terms of travel, and everything got really scary in terms of, you know, livelihood and health and all of that. But that's about the time I reached out to you, because I think that the season just felt like change was necessary. And I think that you weren't developing the podcast yet, but you were publishing pretty regular newsletters, which felt to me like they carried the weight of what some of these podcast episodes do. And so I had gotten on your newsletter list and set up one of your free coaching offerings. And my experience of that free conversation was, wow, I don't think that I've ever had my situation articulated so clearly or how I feel about my situation articulated as clearly as Kate has articulated my situation and how I feel about it back to me after an hour long phone conversation. And that ultimately was like the turning point for me of feeling ready. And then, you know, once we started working together, I don't know if you do this with everybody or if it's just you sense what folks are going to benefit from the most from a coaching engagement, but I found so much accountability help from you in terms of actually taking steps towards what I wanted to be doing. And at first that was just a lot of research because that's my brain. Mm-hmm. Your question about how did I know I wanted to be a Rolfer? When I came to you, I knew that I wanted to be doing something that had to do with embodiment, something that had to do with helping people build more healthful and loving and agency-based relationships with their bodies. And that I knew that because of my yoga teaching practice. I think that I knew I wanted to be a Rolfer because I had had such a transformational experience with my body with Rolfing, but I was paralyzed by fear of making a wrong decision. And mm-hmm. so you gave me an assignment of like, okay, go and interview people from each of the modalities and disciplines that you're considering. And basically, as soon as I got that homework assignment and started talking to people, I knew that Rolfing was what I wanted to do. And I think even the people that I was talking to were like, you should just figure out how to get to the Rolf Academy or the Rolf Institute, mm-hmm. because that's clearly what you're most excited about. But yeah, my anxiety about making the wrong choice was big. And so it took probably 2 or 3 months to believe that my gut was accurate or correct, which in hindsight is so silly. There is no accurate or correct, right? There is what you're interested in, and giving yourself permission to allow that to evolve is half the battle, which was another thing that you provided me with, was permission to be like, okay, let's say that 3 years after you start Rolfing, you want to do something else. Like, can you be okay with that? Like, oh, my head says no, but my heart says yes.
Yeah. It's, I mean, thank you for sharing all of that. It's lovely to hear that that was really supportive. What's coming up for me is curiosity about the specific, okay, I'll put it this way. I think what the people that I tend to work with are on one side or another of maybe financial wellness, let's just say. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, and this is maybe more my story, are like, I don't really know where I fit in this world. So I'm just going to take risk after risk until I find my thing, because there's not really another option. It's not like, oh boy, well, I could do this amazing career in corporate where I would make so much money and I would just be so secure, or I could do this dream path. A lot of people don't actually even have that choice or feel like they have that choice. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I'm aware that there's actually a gift to that, that it's easier to take risks when you don't, whatever, quote unquote, have anything to lose, or when it's like, okay, well, this is just what I have to do because I don't mm-hmm. have another alternative. But I also know, and I've definitely worked with several people who are coming more from that space I think you were coming from, where we could use the phrase golden handcuffs, right? Like, I know that mm-hmm. that's a phrase people use around feeling trapped by making good money and saying, well, if I do this other thing, I may not make as much money as I can make doing this thing that I'm doing now or that I'm capable of doing. I wonder if that came up at all in terms of your journey with scarcity mindset, like, like what, because you know what I mean? It's a different journey, actually. It's a journey of saying, like, busting through the golden handcuffs and saying, what if I could be okay with making less? What if I could be okay with a different lifestyle for a while? Can you speak to that at all?
Yes, I have so many thoughts about this. And yeah, so I grew up with, I will say, a relative amount of financial insecurity. I grew up with a single mom who was trying to figure out how to get all of her kids' needs met. And she was entrepreneurial. And so she wasn't ever relying on a W-2 or a paycheck. And what I know now about my own money beliefs is that I witnessed that, and I grew up wanting anything but that. I grew up knowing that I wanted to have a steady paycheck and that I knew where every dollar was going to come from. And I think that my nervous system overcorrected, because when I ultimately came to you, money was one of the biggest issues. It was one of the biggest things that I didn't even know that I had roadblocks around. And I appreciated the money that I was making. I appreciated the amount of income that was putting me in a position where I wasn't necessarily really having to think about money all of that much. And I was really scared of going to a place where I was going to have to think a lot more about money. What I discovered after having the big scary conversations with, you know, my partner, who I share income with and we share expenses, and actually getting down to numbers and figures and looking at spreadsheets, building spreadsheets, what I discovered was that there was a real empowerment to investing more of myself into examining my relationship with money. And that those handcuffs that I felt related to security, because that's really more what it was. I don't have a lavish lifestyle. I never have. But that really insecure attachment to the concept of security, that it was actually based on a lot of blindness. And so the more that I started tracking what we spent, the more that we started being really thoughtful about where our money goes and how much we could save and all of these factors, that I know that a lot of people have a level of income where they can't, I mean, they're not even tracking because they're just literally wondering where their next meal is coming from. So I want to acknowledge the amount of privilege that I'm coming from with this conversation. And I think that many of the folks in our orbit, Kate, you and I probably operate a little bit closer to this end of the spectrum, which is like, we know that we're going to be getting money and it's our choice how much we engage with the process of examining our relationship with money. So that's a really long way of saying that my relationship with money changed a lot throughout the course of that experience and our coaching engagement. And now I have this completely different perspective. You helped me go through the math exercise of, okay, if you're scared of not having financial security, let's put a number to what financial security means to you. And let's figure out what it would take between teaching yoga and seeing Rolfing clients for you to hit that number for your financial security brain, which I'm glad we went through that exercise. But now that I'm on this side of it, I'm like, that was silly. Like that, I mean, that's not even relevant to me anymore. But at the time, it was such a necessary process for me to remember that there are options, right? That there are resources, that there are ways of resourcing ourselves beyond just getting a paycheck. And today I find that I can really feel more engaged with myself and my life without the security of a biweekly paycheck. And I think, again, that speaks to the amount of disconnected that I was. And I think that that speaks to the degree to which I was feeling those handcuffs, but I would rather be in the position where I am now, which is in this journey, in this practice, thinking really critically and often about money than where I was before, which was not feeling like I really didn't have to think about it at all.
Yeah, that's amazing. So before you had a need for a sense of security and you basically got that from your income and from your paycheck. Where do you now get that need met?
Oh, that is such a good question. That is such a good question, Kate. I think that a part of it was really getting a hold of our expenses and understanding how much money, dollars, we actually have to have in a month in order to have our needs met. That was a huge resource for us because it helped us to stop telling ourselves fibs about how expensive life is. And instead helped us to see what was actually choice and maybe what wasn't. I think that something that a lot of people told me when I started telling people that I would be leaving corporate and going into this work was, well, oh, if it doesn't work out, you still have your marketing skill set to fall back on, which like really was eye-rolly and made me crinkle my nose at the time. And I was like, okay, everybody's got to get comfortable with this in their own way. And so this is a lot of folks' ways of getting comfortable with this really big and probably confusing career choice that I made. But I was actually able to stay on in a contract basis with my former employer. And I was involved with the process of hiring my replacement and wound up hiring somebody who she and I worked really well together. And we decided that she could ask me for help after I had gone on like an hourly basis. And so even though that was sort of akin to the thing that made my eyes roll about people being like, oh, you can always fall back on this, it was a moment of me being like, oh, right. Like this is an option for me with this person, with this organization or with others, should I decide that I'm not having my needs met by this future career that I'm crafting in my vision. And beyond just that skill set, I think it just reminded me that there are other ways of expanding income as well, that it doesn't just have to look one way. And I'm continuing to explore that even today. You know, I'm considering being a part of faculty for yoga teacher trainings. I'm considering different workshop offerings and thinking about how I can expand even my Rolfing practice. So I think that just knowing and trusting that there are many ways to resource, many opportunities to resource, and that the resource actually exists as long as we're engaged with it and curious about it. That's an awareness that I didn't have before.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, when I think of the transition you've made and kind of how it feels to me, where I guess I've never really had that kind of security, like a really great paycheck from an employer, it's never been part of my reality. But what I do experience and what I kind of witness you seeming like you're experiencing is that what gives me a sense of security is loving what I do. And it's because I have what feels to me anyway, like an almost endless pool of passion and creativity and interest and willingness to show up for it. So even if it's like a bad week or a bad month or whatever, like I'm not getting as many clients as I'd like or whatever, I know that I'm not going to hit a wall where I'm quitting. I'm not going to hit a wall where what I think I do see a lot when people are either burning out, or I really like your distinction of it actually wasn't burnout. And that's when I really knew it was time to go, because it wasn't like, I just need a vacation. It was like, no, there is no sustainable future here for somebody who doesn't have, who cannot continue to devote their creative life force energy into this thing for the foreseeable future. That's not security, right? That's actually, it can feel incredibly insecure, because you know it's like a little ticking clock that's like, how many more days can I actually suffer this before I will just like freak out and quit? And that's not security. But when you know that you're kind of in that expansive growth place where you're like, yeah, I'd like to keep learning about this thing forever, and I'm just going to keep getting better and better and more masterful at it as long as I can. To me, that provides a level of security that I think is really satisfying.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I definitely would not have come up with that alone. But now that you're saying it, I'm like snapping and nodding. And yes, I can absolutely relate to that.
Yeah, so cool. Great to see things growing for you and growing in your wealth and career, and you just in that place you're at right now of having found resource in a lot of different places besides, you know, money being of course a very important resource, but not the only resource, right? And I think that's what happens is if we sacrifice too many other of our resources for that one, then we forget about the other ones. We're just like, oh no, those are important. So the question I like to close the podcast with is, based on your work, what is the opposite of scarcity? And I want to invite you to name that whatever you'd like, but I already heard you start to name this thing of embodiment. And I know we wanted to talk a little bit more about that. And so maybe it's a two-parter of, is it embodiment? Is it something else? Can you elaborate on how embodiment becomes a space beyond scarce opportunity?
Sure. Yeah, I think that I agree with the premise of embodiment being a resource for moving out of scarcity mindset. Maybe it could stand alone, like developing greater awareness of your body, being able to fully inhabit your body versus objectify the body and think of the body as like a machine separate from yourself. I think that these are all really amazing resources and really amazing transformations that are available. I think that we're still really subjected to all of those systems and all of those forces that I just briefly mentioned in the beginning of the interview. And so, yes, embodiment. And I think with embodiment, there must still be a bit of conscious conviction around boundaries and around examining the space that you're occupying and examining the world around you. And maybe I'm talking myself out of this a little bit, but I think that those two things, in their most brilliant and most impactful state, can really only be done from somebody who is embodied, from somebody who is sitting with their true self, feeling grounded, feeling their own capacity to show up fully. I think the folks who are able to do that are the ones who are most skillful or most capable of setting boundaries that are sustainable or that are compassionate or that facilitate the ability to be without scarcity mindset. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that being embodied is maybe not a requirement for taking that really rigorous lens to your own status or your own social location almost. Like I think the distinction that I want to make is that like just being able to feel your own body is not actually going to protect you from scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
Feeling your own body, feeling grounded, I think is foundational. And I think that it provides you with the resource to then go and learn how to set boundaries, to then go and learn about these systems of oppression and predatory capitalism and all of these things that create these inequities. And I think that it gives us the foundation to go and see and witness and feel and hear some of the really hard things about our world right now, and to feel like we still have the resource to show up and try to help however we can. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think that embodiment is crucial, and I think that it is foundational, but it's not, in my perspective or purview, a catch-all. I think that there's merits to it, and I think that it's a worthwhile journey, and I don't want to diminish the scope of the problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you said earlier about how one of the first things you do is to help clients be able to sit with their pain or experience the full spectrum of their pain, that almost to me is one of the opposites of scarcity thinking. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that quite that way before. Cause you know, a lot of people are like, it's abundance, or it's all these, you know, warm, fuzzy, fluffy things. Yeah. But actually being able to sit with the full spectrum of your pain, I think is also part of it, because that is where we tend to flip into like, well, because I'm completely unwilling to experience any pain or suffering, therefore I require for myself enough resource to never, ever, ever have to feel that. And that's an unreasonable requirement that will leave you mm-hmm. feeling scarce, because, you know, we're human and it actually is a resource to be able to feel that full spectrum and increase your capacity for it. And what I hear you saying is that some of the tools of embodiment are an important part of that process.
Researchers have been able to find to tap into those activations with our brain is to use imagination. Mm-hmm. And that like blew my mind when I learned it. It's called like the gamma loop cycle or something like that. Again, I wish that I had brushed up on this before this chat, but when I was exposed to this idea and I was like, oh my gosh, you are telling me that something is as profoundly impactful and constantly spoken about as posture mm-hmm. is not something that we can cognitively fix. It is something yeah. that we have to be able to be in relationship with and to use different parts of our brain to stimulate in a way mm-hmm. that's going to help us to change patterns over time. Really blew my mind. And it's something that I think about a lot. And it's something that I think expands out as well to your point of like, there's the mm-hmm. conscious way of thinking, and then there's this other way of body thinking.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. It brings me back to all my many modalities of movement training I have are from theater. And so much of it is working with imagery and imagination to elicit a response from your body. And so, and it is immediate and powerful, and it's not mm-hmm. as much of a chore as like when you go to a really structural, like say yoga class, where it's like, do this exact thing with this muscle this many times. I mean, most yoga classes aren't like that, because actually yoga does an amazing job of balancing that. But you know, that like maybe just very dry technical approach that wouldn't elicit qualities and flavors and be evocative to your imagination. So, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I feel like we could do a whole nother podcast about that and talk for so much longer, but you know, we have to wrap up. So I will definitely be putting a link in the show notes to your website and your Rolfing practice, which I know people are going to be excited to check out if they're in the Portland area. And actually you have some great resources, even if people are not in Portland, because I know you put out a newsletter with great resources and videos, and you teach some yoga online, right?
Yeah, I teach quite a few hybrid classes. So they're the types of classes that I'm teaching in studio, but that are also available live stream. And that schedule is available on my website. And thanks for bringing up my newsletter. It's my little love child project. I'm somebody who, because of the amount of time that I've been nerding out about this stuff, and to finally be in a career where my training, my self-study on it has kind of a vessel, I've been pouring a lot of myself into those newsletters. So each one is pretty long.
Yeah.
But it's
they're great.
Thank you. Yeah, it's chock full of musings. And I've started a practice of putting a movement tutorial into each of them for folks who just want to wiggle around with me a little bit. So yeah, I'd welcome any and all folks who want to check that out too.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll make sure to link those in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Kat. It was really great to hear about your journey, where you're at now, and I can't wait to come visit you at your practice one day.
Oh, thank you, Kate, and thank you for all of the support. It's been truly transformational.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of The Space Beyond Scarce. If you enjoyed this episode, please go over to Apple iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and review.